being committed. State institutions are serving 3 to 5 year hitches. That's the time of the sentence. The actual time inside was about 12 months. So the intent of the act was to identify those offenders and somehow through CCA begin to develop a formula whereby the community could plan for dealing with those offenders. At the beginning of the Community Corrections Act, it was conceived to be very broad. And the idea there was it simply allowed many different communities to come in and then to form their own formula. The intention of the payback was obviously to reward or to penalize, as I should say, those communities which said, fine, we want the money, but we're not willing to deal with Class Cs. And that's been the problem in Multnomah County and some other communities that have simply wanted the funds but have not been able to successfully deal with the question of their commitment rate. So I feel like there's a way that we can work with these large communities that have high commitment rates. On page 2 of the pass out was a master plan. And we found that when sentencing alternatives are available to the judge, that he will use those alternatives. And we really need in Multnomah County and Lane and some other communities other facilities available. As you know, there are 4 facilities that are being funded now through CCA, Multnomah, Marion, Clackamas, Washington County. Each have a probation center. There's about 340,000 per buy-in that flows into those facilities. Those facilities are being used. If we had more facilities of the same type, then they would really be funded. So our concern is that we continue to fund in the area of facilities. On the last page were a series of concepts that came out of one of the statewide bonding issues in August 1 of 1980. Our concern is that we continue to provide facilities in the community, state-funded, primarily dealing with felons operated by the communities themselves. So I believe there is a way to deal with the facility question to meet the needs. I believe that CCA is the mechanism that we can continue to use. And so one of the concerns that I would have is that we continue to tie in what we're already doing within these communities and that we have a state-county cooperation. And I believe that can be done, but I'm not sure this bill will get us there.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. I guess I'm sorry that I wasn't here for the opening of your testimony, but the concern you'd have in relationship to the bill that's in front of us is that the formula is not going to achieve the purposes I'm not certain.
No, I believe
I'm trying to relate this to the 24 to 28.
Having served on the State Advisory Board for Community Corrections, we had to come up in the early days with a formula that would allocate this and other kinds of funds. And I believe the State Advisory Board is the best group that I know of that simply take a look at this issue and bring back to this group, if needs be, some kind of here's what we're planning to do, here's how the funds would be used. To my understanding, that has not been done. Because we've not planned ahead, you're now faced with the decision of one community coming in and saying, we want to change the whole thing. I serve on our advisory board in our community here in Salem, and I know very well this simply would affect us. It would affect other communities. So I guess I'm concerned that one county comes in and says we want a special law dealing with our needs. I believe there are particular needs in Multnomah County that we need to address, especially in the area of funding for felons and facilities for felons. But I'm not sure that this bill is the way to do it.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Adams.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to be heard on House Bill 2428? Mr. Cornbert?
Cy Cornbrook, Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. We basically support this bill. I don't think it goes far enough. I think there's other problems that need addressing with the payback. I think what this does, and I did not testify on 2660, so that I didn't come in and have a position there that I am now changing. I think what it does, it gives a readily ascertainable amount to the counties, and we don't end up with the rights of competition. We don't think, the parole and probation officers think that payback has outlived its usefulness. We think the corrections decisions are being made in this state unfortunately, on whether it will cost money, except not on the basis, is it a good correctional decision. I think that the space problem has become such a great problem in this state that everybody is aware that they have to do everything they can to keep people on the streets. And I would offer, as I indicated, I think this bill might be a vehicle for a compromise. If elimination of payback is not feasible, I think that there is something to be said that if an offender is treated for a crime, goes through a drug program, goes through an alcohol program, stays out on the streets for a period of time, and the county has put money into that person in the enhancement funds, that they should not be penalized for the full amount of $3,000. I think what we're doing in those cases is reinforcing the proposition that the offenders are not responsible for their actions, that we are somehow collectively failing them. And I think that is poor policy. I think that if somebody goes through everything in spite of all our best efforts, keeps goofing up and fails and ends up going to prison, that after 2 years and programs, that there should not be the liability for a $3,000 payback when the county has invested their funds in those services. And I would like to see this bill used as a vehicle to do something in that area, because I think it's very important. As far as the distribution, I think it's important that the county be able to have some idea what they're going to get back. But I think that payback idea, I think it's a real mistake to say that you've invested in a drug program, in a mental health program, in a restitution center at the beginning, and then a year or two down the road, after you've had them in and out of local facilities and in and out of treatment and doing these things, a person continues to commit crimes, that's somehow the fault of the system, not the fault of the individual.
Fine. Questions? Thank you, sir. Okay, if there's no one else testifying, House Bill 2428, we'll close the hearing on that bill and move to House Bill 2426, relating to corrections officers. Mary Botkin. Brought your expert witness.
Mr. Chair, I lost one of my officers here in the last couple of seconds. I'm sure she'll be right back.
All right.
So when she comes back in, we'll have her join us.
We can take half your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing AFSCME Council 75, and we represent the corrections officers at most of the maximum security institutions here in Oregon. We want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill. This bill has been introduced at our request. This would be the third session that we've introduced this bill, and for 6 years, our officers have waited for the kind of training program this bill will allow. Let us explain to you both the need for the bill, the way the bill will answer current problems, and how you as a committee can assist us in these efforts. Our officers work in the most overcrowded maximum security institutions on the West Coast. Most of our officers work in areas where staff inmate ratios top 20 to 1. They carry no weapons with which to defend themselves. Their only defense against inmate attacks is their whistle and their wits. The president of our local union at the Oregon State Penitentiary is currently on permanent disability because he was attacked by inmates. The man is less than 50 years old, and he will never work again, in or out of OSP. He didn't blow the whistle fast enough, and had he blown the whistle, there wouldn't have been enough officers to assist him in the attack anyway. Our officers are hired to detain the most ruthless, dangerous individuals in our society. These are the individuals that we as citizens expect to be kept away from our homes, families, and neighborhoods. Many of these inmates hurt people just because they like to. The men and women who work in these institutions are charged with the continuing care of the people who have proven their inability to live in a free society. These men and women are charged with the job of counseling, feeding, caring for, protecting against themselves and other inmates, and rehabilitating the inmates so that they will be able to return to a free society and live out the rest of their lives without further problems. So you might ask, why this bill? We'd like to take you through the process of the officer who is hired. First, they enter a one-week program orientation period. This is known as the training of corrections officers. They receive some self-defense, some practical law, search and seizure, a little information on how to protect the inmates' rights under the law and how to protect their own. They're also informed on how the state system works, what type of benefits they will receive, who they are responsible to, and how to fill out the forms. Once they've gone through this orientation training period, they're assigned to a duty post. If they're lucky, they will be assigned to an officer who has gone through this, they will be assigned to an officer with experience and the proven ability to train and teach the new officer on how to survive the maximum security institution. However, more often than not, the situation is that the new officer is sent into the institution without the benefit of a well-qualified, proven trainer. Little regard is given to their level of ability or fears. Within the last 2 weeks, we've had four officers attacked and sent to the hospital, and these were experienced officers. In every sector of public safety, law enforcement and corrections, we require that the men and women who work in this area have the highest level of training. A police officer receives more training than our state corrections officers, who must hold the felons that the officer arrests for the length of their sentence. Community corrections officers receive the same level of training. The state corrections officer is the only person in the state who is expected to do their job without the proper training to do the job we're asking them to do. This bill will finally bring into law the requirement that every corrections officer in the state of Oregon be trained and certified by the Bureau of Police Standards and Training, BPST. The idea of professional training for corrections officers is not new. In fact, we are one of the only states who does not require our officers to be certified. Other states have set up alternative programs for corrections officers only. While we would heartily endorse this type of program in Oregon, we realize that the state simply cannot afford to do this at this time. We do believe that the BPST program offers everything that is needed and also provides us with the environment needed to ensure quality training free from political overtones and roller coaster programs, up today and down tomorrow. We have worked hard to put a bill before you that will give the officers what they need, the BPST Academy the ability to develop the training programs, the corrections division the input that they require, and the line officers some ability to add their input. Too often we have seen and heard promises of training only to be let down time and time again. We're no longer interested in empty promises and false starts. These men and women risk their lives on a daily basis to protect you and your to keep you and your family safe. What they need is your promise to give them the skills they need to do their job and keep themselves safe so that they may too live out a full productive work career. Thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mary. During the interim, you were here in front of the committee with another individual, I believe, Tina. With you at that time. Did she want to make some comments now? And
Tina, with me today is Tina Morfitt-Turner. Tina Turner Morfitt. And Tina is the vice president of our Oregon Women's Correctional Center. And Dave Cortez, who is our newly elected president, I think the committee members, many of you know Dave, he's just been reelected again president at the Oregon State Penitentiary. And they both will have comments to make.
As I believe during the interim, Tina, you mentioned at one time that you'd been with the Women's Correctional Institute for about 5 years, and that the nature of the kind of prisoners that you were seeing here changed pretty drastically in that period of time, which
yes,
required,
ma'am.
So you might want to put me on your comments.
Okay. For the record, my name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I'm a correctional corporal at the Oregon Women's Correctional Center. My date of employment goes back to August of 80. During that time period, yes, our clientele has changed quite a bit. When I first arrived, our clientele were somewhat older. We did have some younger clients who kind of came and went. We had a lot of them who were forgers and so forth. Now our clientele seems to have changed. We still have older clients coming in, but we're getting a very high influx of hire of younger clients. They are a bit more ruthless. They feel as though they have less to lose given their age. They feel they're willing to do the time for any infractions that they might commit while they're within the institution, including the harming or the injuring of a correctional officer. They have kind of, some of them have a devil-may-care attitude as far as how they approach people. A lot of them are to the point where if they want something, they want it now. Does that give you a pretty good example of what we have to deal with?
Obviously, you feel additional training is necessary.
Well, it's not so much the additional training. I think what we need is a universal training, okay? We, throughout the Corrections Division, are permitted to laterally transfer from one institution to the other. At the Women's Center, we do have some ongoing training, but at the penitentiary, there is none that I know of, okay? An officer who comes in from the penitentiary to the Women's Center would come online in a matter of years or a matter of months, but for an officer to go from the Women's Center to the penitentiary could not. And my basic concern is given the high security level of where we have to work, given to the fact that we are sometimes placed in isolated situations and isolated places, I think that it is very necessary for us to all have the correct amount of training so that we can act properly in saving our own lives, not to only to mention the lives of an inmate who is being attacked.
Thank you. Mr. Cortez, did you wish to make a comment?
Yeah. Excuse me. For the record, my name is David Cortez, and I'm a correctional corporal for Corrections Industries, and I'm president of Aspen Local 2623. I think that the key to this bill is the fact that with the passage of this bill, it dictates that training will take place in corrections, and this is something we don't have. I've been employed at the penitentiary now for 15 years. Prior to 1980, we occasionally had some training as relates to riot control, the use of weapons and tear gas and that, and basically riot control training. In 1980, we did have some training, 40 hours of training, as a matter of fact, which was quite costly to the penitentiary. And it was the only training that we had had basically relating to the professionalism of an employee at the penitentiary. Since that time, the only training we had was when I got together with Mr. Cup at the penitentiary and we developed the voluntary training program where people could volunteer to attend classes and that. And the courses or the classes that we had were good, but the point of it is that there was no money and we keep fighting for it. At this time, I believe that people of Oregon need professional correctional officers working in our prisons. The type of inmate that we have, the fact that most of your inmates who have had shorter sentences than that have all left the prison, and the hardcore inmate basically are those who are serving mandatory sentences such as 20 and 30 years. Those are the people we're getting in the prisons now. So we're having to deal with a different type of person, one who can't look at being out on the street in 10 or 18 months, but people who are going to be there for a long time. A year or so before Mr. Cupp left as superintendent, we were discussing training, and he told me that his biggest regret as superintendent was that he had to discipline employees into being correctional officers. When they made mistakes, he had to make them learn not to ever make that mistake again, and then we're talking about a discipline that included suspensions and demotions and stuff like that, where you're talking about monetary discipline. So if you can't train them, we'll discipline them into it. And at the same point in time, they begin requiring that we be more professional, yet they never gave us the tools to work with to be professional. And if you take and throw a new officer into an institution, and that officer is going to learn from another officer, what makes us believe that the officer that he's learning from knows what the proper way of doing the job is? So in most cases, what we're doing is we're just duplicating a problem that's already in existence. We need something that is a criteria that is an established criteria that says that all correctional officers will function in a certain manner, and this is what the professional standards of a correctional officer are.
And you're familiar with the kind of training that the board does, is that they have to establish a new set of training functions to accommodate corrections officers? Do you think there's existing training that you would be able to fit into over there?
We've had a couple of officers who have gone through BPST, and they said that many of the programs that they have are comparable to what we would need at OSP. They would have to develop some new criteria or some curriculum there for corrections specifically.
There's a subsequent referral on this bill to Ways and Means, but do you have any idea what the fiscal impact might be?
I believe Mary would have that.
Currently, we're looking at about a $1.2 million fiscal impact on this bill. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less, depending on how ruthless we can get with the figures and how creative. Last session, I would like to draw your attention to Section 2 of the bill on page 2. This section reflects work that we did in the last session on developing the kinds of amendments that were needed to make sure that the training program was established in cooperation with all three parties, the union, the division, and BPST. With BPST having the oversight of that training, but certainly not doing the entire program without input from the other two important parts of the process.
All right, President Brown, thank you very much.
I'd just like to encourage you all to move this bill down to Ways and Means as quickly as you can. It is imperative that we get it down there so that as we start working on budgets that are similar to this, that we can identify the money and get that money set aside.
I think council has a question here.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Representative Miller?
I just briefly, you said this is the third time you've brought this here. Is money the only problem that is?
Money's the only problem. We keep scurrying around trying to find the $1 million. Got any?
I think lottery tickets.
Last year they talked about a new post factor at the penitentiary, since our post factor was lower than what it should have been, and they felt that they could include part of that post factor would include training monies, but that went by the wayside also.
Council, I think, had a question.
Mary, has there been any negligent retention suits against the department as a result of contending that the training is inadequate?
I understand that OPEU will be testifying next. They do have some information on that. We certainly are taking a look at possible litigation and legal remedies to address the problems with our officers that are injured or attacked inside the institutions, and taking a look at legal steps against the state for improper and lack of training as a result of that.
One additional question. Do you feel that with the current training, that there may be a potential for a suit against the Corrections Division, alleging that its officers are inadequately trained and as a result someone was injured?
We think that there's a basis there, and I can tell you, Bill, that we're working with our counsel, with the union attorneys now, looking into that as a potential.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Teichu.
For the record, my name is Dick Teichu. I'm president of Local 289 at OSCI. I have 25 years experience as an officer sergeant and correctional counselor 2 and 3, all in the same facility. My statement is, Mr. Chairman and subcommittee members, my name is Dick Teichu. I'm president of Local Oregon Public Employees, Local 289, representing about 188 employees at the Oregon State Correctional Institution. I'd like to speak briefly to you today in support of Bill House 2426. In behalf of the 120 correctional officers, correctional corporals, and sergeants working at OSCI, as well as our members in job classes outside the correctional officer series, we believe that phasing in police board, Board of Police standards and training and certification for Corrections Division officers, as is called for on this House bill, is essential to maintaining the current security being delivered at Oregon Correctional Institution and other institutions as well. Further, the allocation of time and money House Bill 2426 would entail represents, in our view, an investment opportunity that would be negligent, if not tragic, to fail to take advantage of in light of the prospects for liabilities to the state arising from continuing to stretch existing resources as we are today. The concern with this situation among Local 289 members is such that 107 of us signed 2 unsafe employment practice complaints that were filed with the Accident Prevention Division in May and July of last year by Local 289, which expressed our strongly held views that current staffing and other practices pose unnecessary dangers to the health and safety of OSCI members, let alone to our inmates. That these concerns have merit is shown clearly by the citation and the hazard letter subsequently issued to OSCI by the Accident Prevention Division on January the 30th, 1987. And there's copies of those attached to my statement. Although I believe the entirety of this citation would be of interest to you, I'd like to direct your attention to paragraph 1 on the citation and notice of penalties, which state, and I quote, "The employer did not properly instruct all employees on how to perform their jobs in a safe and healthful manner. Employees were put to work without receiving adequate training on the hazards associated with working alone with inmates, nor were they instructed on how to handle emergency situations that might occur while working with inmates. In addition, employees were not notified about changes in the emergency backup procedures while working in the recreation yard, nor were they trained on what the new procedures were," end quote. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today, and I'd welcome questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker. Do you have any officers who have been through the board training?
Pardon?
Of the 100, I think you said 120, 188 officers that you have in your group, are you aware of any of those who have been through board police standard training?
Not fully through the board standards as a prerequisite for the job, but we all at various times have gone through training that was only offered through BPST. Therefore, we got the quality of their services, but it was specialty training.
I know it's difficult to generalize, but mm-hmm. If you could take a take an average person in your organization, what kind of training would, or how much training would you say that individual has as a correctional officer?
As average, Mr. Chairperson, probably the standard week training, I think that's 40 hours that division offers, and then over the last 18 months or so, while our budget was depleted, it would be OJT on-job training. And again, as the people before me testified, if you were lucky and was able to be personally assigned to an experienced officer, you probably got at least 20 to 25% of what he knew. And that's probably, I think, educational value. That's retention level. You forgot the rest of it. So it's at the hazard and the handicap of quality of the person you're assigned to and how well you absorb it.
You say 40 hours. Are you talking about 40 hours initially or 40 hours annually, or is that?
Well, yeah. I think, and we were originally going under a standard that was established as a federal standard, and it was 40 hours annually for some people, 90 hours for other people in more critical conditions, like, for instance, isolation and security, security unit, which takes a special qualification because you're handling a specially aggressive, hostile inmate. But basically, the 40 was matched that way, but we've had to look for it.
Might not like the bill. During the last election cycle, I drove around out in the country and spotted about 30 violations, mostly signs, particularly in farmyards and fields and all those things, dealing with anything from school levies to the marijuana issue to candidates, all of which were in violation of the law. Some of the farmers had a dozen or more signs, each sign constituting a separate violation. I was going to file a massive complaint. And then after being assured that Secretary of State Roberts favored the concept we were reaching, then I decided not to. But in any event, this bill would give the Secretary of State the opportunity, if she chose to enforce those particular laws. Right now, there is no method really to enforce them.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. Do you have anything further you want to say?
Two comments that I'd like to make. One is that in anticipation of this hearing, we looked at some of the complaints that are currently pending to get an idea of where we are. And I might reiterate what the two speakers have said, that we do have currently in the Attorney General's office a misdemeanor with someone who failed to identify a piece of material. We have no choice but to send that over to the Attorney General's office. We've been billed for 47 hours worth so far and have not received a response on that. And it would be possible, to the purpose of serving justice, for us to have had that and gone through the civil penalty procedure and taken care of that complaint. We think it's an advantage both to the people who are involved in the process as well as to our office. There is no question that it will increase our workload. We will be under a different procedure, which will require us to have an opportunity for public hearing, a hearing. As
Did you say 47 hours?
Yes.
I just wanted it's been sitting here rattling around. Thank you.
As Mr. McMurdo said, we do offer that opportunity to CNEs right now, CNE violations, and currently less than 10% of those people request the hearing, so we think we'll be able to absorb some of that. But we support the bill and think it's in the best interest of everyone involved.
As I recall, Mr. Chairman, the average cost for these types of misdemeanor investigations was in excess of $2,000 each. And while there will be some additional cost, undoubtedly, to the Secretary of State, there will be undoubtedly cost savings to the Secretary of State.
Our election law violations this biennium thus far, and again, these include these statutes and other statutes as well, is $90,000 today. So we're hoping that with removing some of these misdemeanors into the civil penalty system, that will eliminate some of our costs from the Attorney General's office as well.
I didn't catch the offense that's with the AG's office right now. What was the violation?
Failure to properly identify printed material.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm surprised the Attorney General's office isn't here to testify. Is there anyone here from the Attorney General's office to testify? I think they ought to be opposed to this. Okay, thank you very much. Wave into the camera.
Thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
You.
Chairman.
Appreciate that. Thank anyone else wishes to be heard on House Bill 2336? That will close the hearing on
thank you.
That bill. Open a hearing on House Bill 2437. I have a couple people scheduled to testify. I'm wondering, since we're going to have to hold another session, this anyway, because some amendments coming up. If it's not immediate, we'll simply pass by that bill. Is there anyone else? Is there anyone here to testify on House Bill 2437 besides Ms. Botkin and Mr. Conrad? Okay, I think we'll hold that one over then. And move to House Bill 2333 on corrections. And there is before you, members of the committee, a large, it's a large bill, but there's also a large set of amendments. It's my understanding that there may be some additional amendments coming to this bill, and I think probably what we'll do at this point is ask Mr. Toombs to just introduce this to us at this point, essentially, because we will have to hold further sessions on it, and you might want to introduce the amendments. They're coming out. This is the bill that creates Corrections Department.
Do you have any amendments?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Toombs. I'm the administrator of the Corrections Division. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2333, which was submitted by Governor Goldschmidt to create a separate Department of Corrections. As the chairman has already pointed out, this is a rather lengthy bill, and to assist you, the division has created a summary of the bill by sections. And the majority of the bill's contents are housekeeping in nature. By that I mean many of the changes inherent in the bill as it was originally drafted are simply deletions of references to the Division of Corrections as a part of the Department of Human Resources and substituting the words Department of Corrections. Likewise, we have struck references, which wherever they exist in the statutes, to the title of Assistant Director of Department of Human Resources and inserted in its place Director of Department of Corrections. We've also removed some archaic references to statutory languages which tied the division institutions back to the days of the Board of Control and inserted generic terms referring to, for example, Department of Corrections institutions in their place. None of these changes, in our view, constitute major policy questions once one settles the question of whether or not you want a Department of Correction. That seems to be the major policy question. Since this bill was initially developed for pre-session filing and after the date for pre-session filings had passed, however, other proposals relating to corrections have been developed and are being presented to you as proposed amendments to this House bill. And I've been instructed, as the chairman has already indicated, that to inform you that additional proposed amendments may also be presented on other policy matters at a later date after review by the governor and staff who've just recently been appointed to advise him on legal and other criminal justice matters. So although the major policy amendments have been highlighted for you in the summary, because in our view they constitute significant policy questions, if it is your pleasure, I will give you a brief overview of each of those proposed amendments. The first major amendment proposed requires the establishment of a uniform judgment order, making it a part of ORS Chapter 137 for use by all sentencing courts statewide. In addition, the amendment to ORS 137-320 would require each court to provide the Department of Corrections with a copy of the examining psychiatrist's written report or reports prepared on any inmate sentenced under the provisions of ORS 16725 and 735, which are the dangerous offender statutes.
The second major amendment is a proposal to revise ORS 144.120, eliminating the provision that the Board of Parole be required to hold mandatory hearings to set an initial prison term within 6 months following reception of an inmate in a corrections division institution. The parole board is currently required to hold hearings on all new commitments within 6 months, and that is an extremely heavy workload for those board members and very, very difficult under current circumstances to keep pace with it. And even without the possibility of additional institutions being geographically located around the state in various regions, it is the division's view that hearings should not be mandatory, but rather be provided only when the prison term set by the board is contested. The proposed amendment would allow the board to set the initial prison term on the basis of the record, with the provision for the inmate, victim, or the district attorney to request a hearing if they wish to contest the prison term. The amendment would also propose to change the time frame for setting the initial prison term. Inmates sentenced to life for 20 years under this amendment would be moved to 1 year, with the six-month limitation continuing to be applied to all other offenders. The third major amendment proposed in ORS 144-125 is to ORS 144-125. Under the current law, once the initial prison term is set, neither the board nor the corrections division has adequate authority to delay the prisoner's release if there is no adequate plan which provides for suitable housing and support for the prisoner upon release. The essence of this amendment would allow the Department of Corrections to recommend to the board deferral of release for a specified period of time when such circumstances exist, and give the board authority to grant deferral until an adequate plan can be developed. The next major amendment is to ORS 423-525, and as you already know, the governor has created a governor's task force for correctional facility siting. When House Bill 2323 was originally drafted, the thinking was that the task force would be created as a permanent commission. Therefore, House Bill 2333 proposed the abolishment of the Community Corrections Advisory Board to be replaced by the Commission on Corrections. Given the creation of the task force, it is the governor's desire to retain the Advisory Board on Community Corrections. The amendment to ORS 423-525 presented for your consideration, if approved, would continue the Community Corrections Advisory Board. Also included in this amendment is a proposal which would specify that field services programs would be managed either by the county if it chooses to take over responsibility of field services in those counties, or by the state if the county elects not to assume management responsibility. In either case, this amendment proposes that the program plan for services in a county would be predicated upon a plan developed by a local advisory committee and approved by the county commissioners. Under current law, a third option is provided for, which allows the county to contract back for state management of the program. If the proposed amendment is approved, it is our view that it would simplify the administration of field services and community corrections programs.
Excuse me, Ms. Toombs. Representative Springer has a question.
Tom, can I, just so I understand, I think I know what this means, but how is this going to affect the three options, basically, that are available or now being utilized under community corrections? Are you saying we're going from three to two options, basically, and what's your sense of how that's going to impact the counties that are now out there operating under any of the different three options that are now available?
You're absolutely correct. It does propose to reduce it from three to two, and there are some other proposals that are tied to that that we think will afford greater opportunity for participation and a more equitable distribution of resources. For example, state offices who are now managing field services get less funds under the total appropriation process than a county operation does, and some state staff have said, well, if we got the same amount of money, we could do as good a job. If these changes were approved, they would get an equal amount of money based upon a plan developed by an advisory committee and approved by the county commission, have a ceiling for Class C penalty paybacks just like everybody else who does, who participates in the act, and in essence they'd have to prove that in fact they can deliver the services the same way that the county managed program. The basic difference is that it's a question of who manages it. The county could still manage it if they wish to do so, or the state would manage it for them. In either case, however, it's important for us at least, to emphasize that it would be done according to a plan developed at the local level and approved by the county commissioners.
Well, I don't want to oversimplify this, but I guess basically the three options that exist now, the state can do it all, there can be a split, the county can do it all. This option, or this amendment basically says the state is going to have overall management responsibility, or the county will have overall management responsibility, but you're not going to have
the contract back provision.
The contract back. Okay.
So it eliminates option two, which is currently called option two, is that right?
I think that it's option two. I get two and three confused myself.
I think it's two, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
The next major amendment proposed is to RS also to 423, specifically 530. Under current law, funding for field services and community corrections enhancement funds are allocated on the basis of two formulae. One formulae is predicated on workload data and provides for the distribution of traditional case-carrying parole and probation officers on the basis of the total number of parolees and probationers on and temporary leaves being supervised by a given office. The other formulae, which is used to allocate funds for what are referred to as enhancement programs, is based on demographic criminal justice data. Specifically, it's the total population of a county coupled with the amount of reported crime in a county coupled with the total number of people between the ages of 15 and 29 in the county. It is the intent of this amendment to require the use of a single formula based upon demographic data, which is now used for the distribution of enhancement funds. This formula would be developed by the department in cooperation with the counties and should ensure a more equitable distribution of the total resources available for the management of field services programs on a statewide basis. The next major amendment proposed is to ORS 423-525 and ORS 423-550. Under current law, it's our view that it's not clear that a county assuming responsibility for delivery or management of field services and the management of staff who are absorbed by that shift of responsibility are responsible for doing so in accordance with all existing statutes, administrative rules, and collective bargaining agreements. These amendments specify that any county assuming responsibility for the management of field services must comply with all statutes, administrative rules, and collective bargaining agreements, which would otherwise be the responsibility of the Department of Corrections had the county not elected to manage the program. Conversely, it would place the same onus on the state if it is if the county elects to give the state responsibility for managing the program. The final major amendment, which at this time is to ORS 423-570, is still being drafted by Legislative Council, and I don't believe that you've received that yet. It has to do with the supervision fee issue. And what we're proposing is that the $10 a month supervision fee that's now in the statutes be changed, and that in its place there be imposed a $2 a day, this is from $10 a month to $2 a day, for all offenders under the supervision of either the county or the state corrections, depending on who's managing the program, regardless of whether they're in the field or whether they're in incarcerated status. The major issue here as well is that this would be imposed as a judgment order. And although it could be waived for reasons of indigency, the offender has the obligation in like manner to any other judgment order issued. It would allow the county and or the state to go and recover those funds after the individual is judged to be no longer indigent. The funds would be retained by the county if they collect them, by the state if they collect them, to help offset the cost of operating correctional programs in the state. That, in a very quick summary, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, are the essence of the amendments which have been brought before you as it relates to House Bill 2333.
Thank you. Tom, on this last one, I guess maybe we should wait until we see it, but is that $2 a day for each day the offender is under the supervision? And so if it's a 10-year sentence, are we talking about this being?
10 years.
10 years, whether they're off probation or not.
Because under current law, with the victim's modifications in the law, an offender is given a 20-year term and sentenced to the custody of the Corrections Division. They come to an institution, for example, as a preliminary stage of that, and the board gives them a 3-year term while confined. they go back out into the community on parole. The law requires they serve a minimum of 3 years on active supervision. They're then eligible to move into inactive status if they've met all the conditions of parole in an exemplary fashion and have paid all fines, court costs, and restitution. And then they remain under inactive supervision for the duration of the statutory period as specified by the court. The law also says that the division must finance this workload increase out of supervision fees. And so that means that even those people in inactive status are going to have to be charged some minimal fee for the supervision in order to avoid taxing so heavily those that are under active supervision.
Questions? Counsel?
Sure, Tom. What would prevent a person who's being charged $2 a day at the end of the period from going into bankruptcy court and filing a petition for bankruptcy?
Mr. Chairman, counsel, I'm not a lawyer, so I would hesitate to answer that question. I don't know that anything would prevent him from doing it or her from doing it. I don't know what the implications of that would be. I don't know whether bankruptcy causes someone to be rendered no longer obligated under a judgment order or a divorce decree, for example. If a person declares bankruptcy, are they subsequently no longer obligated to make spousal support or child support payments that the court had previously ordered? I guess that's a question that perhaps you're better qualified to answer. I don't know the answer to it.
Considering the kind of legal training we're giving them over there, probably they'll come up with a way to do it.
Mm-hmm. That's also state funded.
Yes, I know. And they have word processors, too. Question, Mr. Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, I want to thank you for this testimony. It's about as good an analysis as I've seen, one that I think we're all capable of understanding easily. There is one question I have, and it goes back to the Second Amendment, and it has to do with the hearings on the sentencing. I wonder if, do you really accomplish anything with this amendment if you say that, you know, the hearing will not be mandatory and will be granted if contested? Don't most folks who are going to be having their term set, wouldn't they contest it?
Yeah. I suppose, Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, you might get different testimony on this from different people. It's our view that because of the crowding situation and because of the rapidity with which certain offenders are being released on parole under the current circumstances, that those who get, some people get a parole order at their initial term. I don't think they're going to contest that. I don't think they're going to challenge it if they're sent a letter and the board has notified them that you're being paroled on such and such a date. And as you know, we now have about 750 people on temporary leaves. Large numbers of those people, or a significant number of those people, are pre-parole hearings, and they're sent out on that program based upon our best calculation or assessment after we take into consideration county jail time served, and we look preliminarily at the crime category history risk score that the board uses to determine the prison term. We take a calculated guess and say this person's likely to get either at his initial hearing either a parole or a parole date that would put him into the criteria where he or she would be eligible for release on parole. So it's our view that a significant number of these people will not contest the decision of the board, but only time would tell. We think it's worth the effort or the trial time in order to ease the workload of the board and to see whether or not it has any practical application.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Toombs. Any further questions on this bill of the amendments? Let me just ask you a question, Tom, where you're up here. House Bill 2029, which was a bill that came out of the Interim Task Force on Government Reorganization, is a very simple bill. It simply states that there will be a correction that would change it from a division to a department. And you may not be able to answer this, but I'm going to look for an answer, I guess, from someone. The facilitating that bill through the legislature would, I think, my sense is that would not be a problem. This bill, 2333, particularly, well, even in itself, but now with these amendments, makes some significant policy changes. Is there a sense that there's an interest on the part of the governor to move 2029 to achieve the purpose he wants in establishing the department, and then review 2333 and its implications? We're obviously going to have significant work sessions on this at a later date. or does it make any difference?
Well, again, I think that the governor would appreciate additional time to deliberate with you these policy issues as well as others that he may be bringing to your attention, so that to the extent that you have the time and the willingness to deliberate with him in that fashion, that House Bill 2333 would still be the preferred vehicle. 2029, in terms of creating a department, does the same thing as 2333 does, except that what they didn't do in drafting that was go through like we did and find all the statutes that have to be changed and otherwise corrected. So the policy question inherent in 2029, as it relates specifically to the creation of a department, is the same structure as 2333. It calls for a department, a director to be appointed by the governor, subject to Senate confirmation, and all those nuances are identical. The difference is those page after page after page where we found statutes that made reference to the Assistant Director for Human Resources or referred to the Division of Corrections in statutes that relate to Interstate Compact and to just a whole host of different legislation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Peter Ozane is here, who is the governor's counsel for corrections. I don't know, did you want to make any comments, or for those of you who don't know him, point him out anyway, because he's been on board, what, 3 days now? So we will undoubtedly be seeing a great deal more of him.
In light of that, I don't thank you for introducing me. I don't have comments.
Thank you very much. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. You want to be, did you want to make some comments, Mr. Sherman, on this?
One or two of the amendments. Cy Kornbrot, Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. There's one amendment that Tom put in that it was basically at our request, but I do think that we're going to have to look at it and do something on the drafting, and that is the amendment that I basically agree with, where a county has assumed full functions under option one, that they will be totally responsible for the labor agreement. The only problem that I see is that there's two types of questions that arise in labor disputes, and one is an individual grievance where or disciplinary that affects one person or maybe a scheduling within that unit, and that's absolutely appropriate to be handled at that level. We have just recently had a grievance and a negotiation in changes of medical insurance rates that went through from the SEB board, and that's something that affects everybody in the large state bargaining unit, and probably should not be allowed to go into one county with maybe eight people working and two state employees and bring that type of grievance and have that settled and maybe settled and maybe a settlement that is binding on the large unit. So I think that some language in there that would speak to grievances that are limited in scope to that county unit might have some value. There's other things that I want to take a better look at those.
But believe it, it's going to take a lot of time looking these. I guess what I'd appreciate is if you have some specific proposals on that bill, that you would discuss that with Mr. Toombs and bring those matters to this committee.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mary Botkin, you want to? I'm going to bypass 2029, however. You may want to make those comments now, or do you want to just?
I have a lot more support for 2333 now that I've listened.
All right.
Then I wasn't sure what it did.
Does anyone else wish to be heard on 2333? If not, we'll be scheduling some heavy-duty work schedules on that particular bill. Thank you. Is there anyone who wishes to be heard on House Bill 2029? You want to make some comments now?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We testified in the interim in support of the concept of House Bill 2029.
I can't remember if it was a bill then or not, but I know that we were looking at it, and we have supported the idea of moving corrections out from underneath the Department of Human Resources, creating its own division. We think it makes a lot of sense. We're certainly going to be tracking 2333 as well to see what that bill does. As I just indicated, House Bill 2333 certainly makes a lot more sense to me now after listening to Mr. Toombs' testimony. We don't have any particular problems with either bill at this point, and again, we'll just be watching it through and be ready to address any problems that may come up to the committee.
Okay, got any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move to House Bill 2093, Lending Criminal Procedures. Mr. Linden here? No, Mr. Knowles?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, David Knowles, Executive Director of the Commission on the Judicial Branch. I just signed up to indicate that I am here and available to answer questions. It is a commission bill, and it has received, testimony has already been received on the subject. I won't add to that now, but I am here to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions yet? Well, Mr. Linden?
You had a question.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. At the first hearing on this bill, I raised some questions we had about the potential fiscal impact of requiring all of our judicial districts to appoint release assistance officers under the terms of this bill. The concern we had then remains now, and basically the feedback we've gotten from some of our outlying counties is that it just simply wouldn't be cost effective to have to appoint release assistance officers as contemplated by the mandatory language of this bill. If that language is retained, there's going to be a need, I believe, to refer this to the Ways and Means Committee because of the fiscal impact that we will feel. We have no difficulties whatsoever with the language concerning the handling of out-of-county arrest warrants, but again, the mandatory language regarding appointment of release officers, and I should